You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey guys, it's your Uncle Drew. I'll never say that again. I just gave myself the creeps. Yo, it's Drew Gasparini here. From now, we're talking with Drew Gasparini. That's right. Just letting you know that you can now support this show on Patreon. Go ahead, become a patron of our podcast today. Just go to patreon.com/NWT podcast. And for as little as $5 a month, you can help a month. That word that I just tried to say was month. You can help keep this podcast alive. I love doing this podcast. It's so fun, but it's a lot of work. From booking the star-studded guest list to research, writing, hosting, recording, editing, and beyond, this particular podcast is truly a one-man operation through and through. I can't hire nobody. So for $5 a month, it really does go a long way. Not to mention the perks that you get by becoming a patron on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/NWT podcast to see how you can support us today. Thank you so much to our patrons, Katie, Elizabeth, Becca, Thomas, Sheena, and Michael. We love you. And happy birthday, Michael. It's not Michael's birthday, but I thought it'd be nice. Anyway, now what y'all waited for? Stop honking. I'm doing a podcast. Jesus. The mother flippin' show, yo. Hello, it's People Magazine's Sexiest Man Alive, 2030 edition. Drew Gasparini here with another amazing episode of Now We're Talking, the podcast that never flosses. I'm crapping my shorts with excitement today because today's guest is a treasure, known for her work on Broadway in such shows as Finian's Rainbow, Big Fish, Hello Dolly, where she starred opposite Bette Midler. Today's guest is a two-time Tony-nominated actress and a Drama Desk nominee for her work in off-Broadway shows such as Giant, John and Jen, and Superhero. I was lucky enough to get to work with her on development of a little upcoming Broadway show called The Karate Kid. Ladies and gents, she's an icon. Now we're talking with the lovely Kate Baldwin.
You're from the Midwest, right?
Indeed I am.
Okay, can I tell you my favorite part about the Midwest?
Sure.
When you order a Bloody Mary, you get a sidecar of beer.
Yes, you do. You also get a full meal on that garnish.
I've seen like a fucking slice of pizza in there. Honestly, honest to God.
Yeah, I'm from Wisconsin, so you get a cheese curd and a pickle.
Oh my God.
You get all that stuff.
You know what's absurd about the whole thing to me is that you also get a meal. Like typically you're not like just ordering a Bloody Mary and then sitting there with your Bloody Mary. You're ordering Bloody Mary because you're at brunch and you're going to get, you know, table pancakes and the omelet and the whole thing. I don't know how people do it. That's my favorite part of the Midwest. Kate Baldwin, Broadway icon. What is your favorite part about being from the Midwest?
Well, now you got me on that that food train because
I love
of course,
it. Let's talk food.
I went to Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, which was founded, that town was founded by like the Women's Christian Temperance Union or something. So you are not allowed to have a Bloody Mary on Sunday unless you order food too. So think about that for a minute. You have to have your plate of pancakes for the table and your Bloody Mary that also has a cheese curd on it and also a sidecar of beer. Like, there's a lot.
What and a I love side about of insulin as well, right? Does it come with... Good Lord.
Well, listen, in the Midwest, we have lots of space. Like, I went back to Milwaukee, to my hometown, a couple of times over the last 5 years. I think I've been there 3 or 4 times. Mm-hmm. And they say, what do you like about it here? I said, there's so much space. Like, nobody's rushing past each other. Nobody's elbowing you. Nobody's giving you a flat tire on your shoe as you're walking in front of
right.
them. Everybody respects your personal space. And
people respect your personal space in New York, too. I remember falling all the way down the stairs on the subway, and everybody just walked right by me. They really, really gave me my personal space.
No one helped you? What the hell happened?
Not a soul. It was like my first week in New York. And I don't know. It was slippery. I think it was February of 2008. Yeah. And I just fell ass backwards down the fucking subway stairs. And I looked around like, hello?
Yeah.
You can see, you're literally stepping over me. And I learned very quickly that that's how New York respects your space.
That's right.
Did you get
hurt?
Of course I got hurt. I got like bruised my knee. I got nothing. My body is mostly battle scars from just falling down in New York City.
And working with collaborators, you know.
And working with collaborators, throwing things at each other, mugs of coffee, sometimes full of coffee, hot steaming piping coffee. I've had those moments.
The burns, as well.
The
burns.
You
the burns
do, yeah. We call it the burns, exactly when that happens. I really appreciate that you're from the Midwest because now you're a Jersey girl.
Yes.
I love Jersey. When you lived in New York City, where did you live?
I lived in a couple different places, but primarily the Upper West Side. I had an apartment on 107th and Riverside that I loved.
Oh my God. I lived on 105th.
When? What years?
And Riverside. For like since, I think between the years of 2011 to 2014.
Yeah, I was already in Brooklyn by that point. Oh, okay. I was there 2003 to 2010. We moved to Brooklyn in we moved to Park Slope in 2010, and Colin or 2011. Colin was born then.
Okay, yeah. So you moved to Jersey when the baby happened.
To Park Slope, Brooklyn, when the baby happened.
And okay, then, Park Slope, and then Jersey when schools happened.
What? When he was five, and we had to get to we had to figure out kindergarten and public schools and kindergarten especially and. Very populous and competitive Park Slope gave me such anxiety, and I had to flee to the suburbs where I knew where my kid would go to school and not have to put him on a list and fill out a form and miss the deadline and not turn it in and like be that mom who was like, but wait, what happened? I didn't get it in on time. I've ruined my child's future. What am I going to do? Sorry, Colin.
Here's what I just talked about parenting. With my girlfriend the other day, not because we're thinking about having kids or anything, but I was talking about my brother, and the stupidest thing that ever came out of my mouth was my brother and sister-in-law are completely different people now that they've had kids. Is that the most no duh sentence that's ever been uttered by a person?
It doesn't quite sink in because the change is so gradual, you know?
Is it?
Yeah, how old are your brother's kids now?
My nephews, I got two beautiful nephews. One is 6 years old and one is 2 years old. And they're both just wrecking balls of boys. Like, they're both, like, honest to God, I don't think they know what a door is. There's just, like, the shape of them through a wall.
Right. And why do you need to actually sit on a chair the way it was meant to be sat upon?
No, like, never. Upside down.
Back. You've got to lay down on it. You've got to be
feet are on it no matter what, with shoes on a lot of the time, I've noticed. What a time to be alive. Here's how I qualify it though. When I think based on the outside observer, I do not have children that I know of. And I thought, looking at my sister-in-law and looking at my brother, it looks like their life was like side by side with mine. And then the two of them got swept up in a giant tumbleweed and they just rolled around for like 5 years. And then the tumbleweed came back and they popped out of it. And they're like, oh, hey, and Drew, you're writing that. That's great. Hey, great. Oh, awesome. And Chloe, you're doing, neat. Like, they're trying to catch up with everybody else's life at every other given moment that they see us because their entire world revolves around these two children.
Yes. It's like your brain gets split in two, right? Like, part of it is the life you always knew, but part of it will always be wondering what that tiny person is doing.
Yes.
And how they're managing the world without you. Or you know, if they're just across the room from you, what are they going to swallow? What are they going to bash their head on? What are they going to...
Oh, my God.
Well, and also, what kind of neuroses am I imparting to them, too, just by staring at them? You know?
Oh, yeah. Because they have to pick up your stresses, too. They must get a sense of that,
They feel it. They feel it no matter what. They feel it. Like, you know, I was sad this weekend. Stephen Sondheim died this past weekend.
Yes,
I was sad. I spent Saturday writing down all the stories that I can remember about him just to make sure that I don't forget him. And my son, at the end of the day, just like, he said, I have something for you. And I said, what? And he just put his arms out and just gave me a giant hug.
No.
He's like, this is for you.
And,
I hadn't said anything about it. I hadn't told him what I was doing or why I was sad, or, you know, I didn't know how to describe.
Oh my God.
What was
you
going
have
on.
A little emotional support son.
I do have an emotional support son. I do. It's a little different, Drew, because you have three siblings, right?
I have three other siblings, yes.
Three siblings, yeah. So I have an only child, and I was listening to Judd Apatow talk the other day, and he was like, you know, when you have two kids and two parents, that's a family. You understand the dynamic. You got kids, you got parents, the whole thing. When you have an only child, it's just, it becomes this other thing. It's like a kid who has to hang out and watch this middle-aged couple be weird with each other.
That
and
is so true.
And I said, Colin, is that what it's like for you? And he was like, every day.
I love that. He's painfully aware of this. Wow, wow, wow. Okay, were you an only child?
No, I have a younger brother.
You have a younger brother.
I had a buffer.
You're the oldest?
I'm the... Drew!
The only reason The only reason I say that... You have baby sister energy.
I do not. I have older sister type A personality, but I hide it very well, Drew.
Okay. Well, it's masked like crazy because I have two younger sisters, and whenever you and I hang out, I feel like that is the vibe I'm picking up is you must have brothers, but you have a younger brother. What's the age difference? Brother.
Just two years.
Okay.
But I'll never forget, like, he was always there for me. Like, he was always a good buffer, you know, and a good, like, person to bounce things off of. He always thought what I was doing was really cool. It was always a flattering thing to, like, have a kid there who was, like, saying, what are we doing now? And he was awesome. And then I'll never forget, I went off to college. And I didn't come home for Thanksgiving 1 year. And he was still at home. So he was probably 17, 18 years old, stuck at home. Yeah. And I went with my college roommate to California for Thanksgiving or something. He called me from our parents' office. Like, he had shut the door. He was having a phone call with me. And he was like, don't you ever leave me at home with them again. I need you here. What are you doing?
See, when you're raised with siblings, you have this immediate like fortress built around you for those moments. Like I couldn't, Danny and I, my brother and I are only 10 and a half months apart. We're very Irish twins. Yes. My brother likes to say that our mom really Catholic'd some kids out is how he phrased it. But when he went to college, you know, I had my two younger sisters and we're all very, very close and that's great. But like he and I were so close. We were like basically tied as one unit. And when he left, I sincerely went through an absolute existential crisis because I felt like half of me was gone. It was the weirdest feeling. And I, every time I called him when he was in college, I was like, when you come back home, how long are you staying? Only a week. All right. But, you know, it was like such a depression my senior year of high school because I didn't even realize how dependent on him I was. Do you think Colin, now that he's an only child here, do you think that this is setting him up to be A+ in any situation now going forward because you have to have this built-in independence as an only child? His imagination must be insane, by the way.
I think he does have a good imagination. I think he also is very used to being by himself and and is okay by himself.
Yeah.
You know, because he's been alone so much. This is interesting, though.
You make it sound like you leave him in the house for hours and hours on end.
No, I'm always the one, Drew, being like, so do you want to play a game? So do you need a snack? So do you, you remember that movie Parenthood and Diane Wiest's character in Parenthood? Hi, Gary. What's in the bag? There are moments. I think I went through a phase when he was like 7 and I was doing Hello Dolly. So I was home rarely and I wanted to make the most of the time that I was home you know, and make it mean something. And that doesn't register with a 7-year-old. He's like, what? I'm just living my life. Oh, you're here. Oh, you're not. Big deal.
Yeah.
But I would be like, let's have hot chocolate and talk about our feelings. Hi, Gary. You know, I would do that. And he'd be like, ew, I'm going to go read a book by myself under a blanket and try to get away from you. Yeah. Yeah.
Tries to get you out of the house. Don't you have errands to run, mother? Don't you have some shopping to do or something?
It was a little leave me alone. But as in terms of a sibling, he would, when he was younger, say, I want a younger brother. But Graham and I realized, my husband Graham, who's an amazing father,
we realized,
I mean, for all the reasons. And he just, we determined that Colin just wanted a little brother so he could boss somebody around. He just thought that a little brother was somebody that you could tell what to do.
Yeah.
And we knew, and we knew that was the main draw. And so we explained to him that wouldn't be the case if you actually had a younger sibling. That probably wouldn't actually happen.
He wanted a minion. He wanted a slave disciple.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. But then, and then he kind of turned the corner because I remember, I think it was like second grade or third grade, he had to write a creative writing project. And he wrote about... It had to include a problem, and the problem he decided was having siblings. And this was the way he opened his project. He's like, You come down the stairs in the morning and you hear arguing and crying. They're there. You go for a snack in the kitchen. Your favorite cookies are gone. They're there. He made it into a horror story about having people who take your stuff and wreck your life. Siblings.
That is great. See, that's the imagination I'm talking about. Everybody I know who's an only child has an imagination that far surpasses any thought I ever have. It's kind of amazing. I love that. That's fantastic.
Sometimes Graham and I just turn to each other and go, they're there. His non-existent siblings. His non-existent siblings.
Can I tell you the best, my favorite example of siblings, and then I'm going to ask you a bunch of other random crap.
Love it.
And by the way, like, I want to preface this. You have one of the greatest Broadway careers ever. And
oh my God,
every time I see you, I say, it's Broadway icon Kate Baldwin. How are you, Kate? Every single time. The reason I'm saying this out loud right now is because, like, we might talk about a few of the shows you've been in, but, like, anybody can Google you. You go Google Kate Baldwin and look up all the amazing things she's done. But in this podcast, I really just want to chat about, like, literally nothing and everything.
I love it.
Okay, so, but real quick, I want to tell you this story of when I was at Disneyland with my whole family, which, you know, when you go with the whole clan, it could be a headache or it could be, like, the greatest time of your life. And this ended up being such a tremendous moment in our life. So we all went down, and I think I was 20 at the time, or maybe 19, and my brother was 20. And then that means Casey and Chloe, my two younger sisters, were about 15 and then 9. Chloe, the youngest.
Aww.
So Chloe, you know, she's raised, but she got two much older brothers, and she's got an attitude about her that I really appreciate and love. And she kind of burps and farts whenever she wants. And, like, that's just kind of the spirit animal she is. And we're all on the train platform for the monorail to take us back to the hotel. You know, it's like the Disney version of waiting for the subway. And we're sitting there, and it looks like a scene out of World War II with all these families huddled up waiting for the train. But we're like a bunch of families standing in a row. So Chloe, my much younger sister, farts super loud, super horrendously loud. And all of us go, Chloe! And these families are looking at us now. And Chloe looks around and sees that everyone's looking at us. And she goes to Casey and goes, yeah, Chloe! And now all it was like the best example of siblings throwing the other siblings under the bus. It was very, very fun.
That's amazing. Oh my God, I love her. That's incredible.
So you mentioned Hello Dolly very briefly when you were talking about being a part of that show. This was your second Tony nomination, right?
Yes.
Okay, I'm making sure I get my facts right. I will confirm. Millimeter of research for any of these things. And I checked out your Wikipedia and everything.
Oh, deep dive. Oh, God.
Anyway, Bette Midler.
Yes.
David Hyde Pierce.
Yes. Yes.
What was it like working with Bette? Like, what are some stories you have about her and David Hyde Pierce?
Amazing. Oh, I got them all. I got all the
I know stories. You do. Let's go, babe. I mean,
this is why we do show business, right? Because we get to be around people like this and crazy things happen. And it's our job as actors and writers to, like, remember them and to store them up and laugh at the absurdity of life. Oh, I love that so much.
Well, and also you have to write your memoir one day and everyone's going to want to know,
I mean, yeah, they're good. Let's see. So Bette Midler, let's see. My favorite Bette Midler story that I tell all the time happened in previews of Hello Dolly. So I played Irene Malloy, and I got to sing a song called Ribbons on My Back. Now, Irene Malloy is the best part ever because you don't come on for the first 45 minutes.
Uh-huh.
You just sit in your dressing room and get ready.
Yeah.
You're literally the last principal character to be introduced to the show.
Yes.
Right when the audience is like, oh, so we put on your Sunday clothes. That's the greatest song ever. I'm so revved to be. Wait a minute. There's a new person here. Well, who the fuck is this?
Yeah.
And why is she singing this song? So anyway, we're in previews. We're doing things like changing little bits of staging and little bits of lighting because the writers are not going to agree to any changes because it's Hello Dolly. And it's
Hello Dolly.
It's classic. So, and only one of them was alive. So I sing my song, Ribbons on My Back. It's 45 minutes into the show. The curtain comes down. The stage manager comes over the god mic and says, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, we have to stop tonight's performance. Also, is there a doctor in the house? There was a man in the audience who had lost consciousness.
Oh,
and of course, since it was New York City, about 12 people stood up and were doctors in the house and came on over. to help this man. And they got him up and they got him out to the lobby, and emergency medical services came and checked him out, and he was fine. He had fainted. He had lost consciousness. He had had some blood pressure or something or other happen.
Yes.
But they said, we would like to take you to the emergency room to do some further testing. And he said, no, I'm not missing Bette Midler and Hello Dolly. I'm not going.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Which is amazing. So he came back and he watched the show, I think. I think that's how it ended. However, we were all backstage having no idea what was going on. And, you know, it was only like 4 or 5 minutes. But, of course, backstage, that feels like an absolute eternity.
Oh, sure.
And we didn't know what had happened. And so I'm standing there in the wings with Bette. And she just turns to me. She goes, well, congratulations. You killed your first audience member.
Your first.
Drew, that's always my question. I'm always like, first.
Doesn't that imply that she's killed several?
There are like, so many questions. There are so many. Like, how many have you killed? Is this one of many? What else? How can I avoid this in the future so that this doesn't happen to me? What do I do?
I love that. I don't know her for shit. I mean, I love her and I follow her on Twitter, and I think she's my favorite person on Twitter. She
I
makes
think
me laugh.
I really like her. Yeah.
I bet I would.
You really
Well, you
would.
Hook up the introduction. Of course, okay. I'd love to meet her. She
of
can
course.
Sing at one of my 54 Below concerts.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
I went and saw that show. I mean, like, what, 2017? Is that when that was on Broadway?
Yeah, that's
you
right.
You were in it when I saw it. Everybody, the whole original team was there.
Yeah.
And all I remember is two things. It may have been my first professional viewing of that musical. Like, I think I've seen like high school productions of it. I've never seen like the iconic, and you guys still had a lot of the iconic like choreography and stuff like that. Can I just say something I don't know if I understand still to this day?
Mm-hmm.
The dance break in Hello Dolly, where mm-hmm. it's the waiters dancing around. Mm-hmm. It is, and the moves are at a glacial pace. It's like a really, it's not like they're doing big kick lines and like tapping around. It got a standing ovation. The gratuitous applause in the middle of that show, not just because Bette Midler came out. You got big applause when you came out. She gets a 5-minute standing ovation for chomping on a chicken bone in the middle of the show. I couldn't believe how many times the audience had to stop and applaud. I was like, we're going to get out of here at 1 a.m.
I know. I had a friend come who doesn't see a whole lot of theater. She loves theater, but she's an athlete.
Yeah.
And she came and she's like, I haven't seen this kind of reaction at a theater performance. I see this kind of reaction at like football games.
Right.
Like people standing up and cheering.
Yes.
Like this kind of, this level of, yeah. I know. It dumbfounded all of us too. We were
Do you think that audience was mostly like an older crowd who was like so pumped Hello Dolly was back, and maybe Bette Midler fans? Or do you think there was a lot of like new people coming in and being like, oh, this is what Broadway has been talking about all this time?
I don't know. I can't speak for the audience. I know that we got a lot of people in to see the show. A lot of audience members came because they're Bette Midler fans, and they weren't necessarily Broadway aficionados.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that they came to see the show and took a chance on and seeing something that is so iconic. And I hate the words old fashioned, because to me it's emblematic of the form, right? That
yeah.
show is so structurally sound.
Yes.
And I think the reason why people were bursting into applause when there was, you know, something akin to a kick line or like a, you know, a walk, yeah. which is what they were doing.
Yeah.
Is because you've been set up to appreciate it. It's not because the move is virtuosic, but because the structure of the show led you to such an appreciation of that joy bomb. I mean, the show is a big
joy bomb.
It's a big old joy bomb. Yeah,
that's what it is. Yeah,
and it's beyond charming. Like, put on your Sunday clothes when that train comes out. It's a wooden train. It's not doing anything really fancy except just going across the stage. But people would lose their minds and start crying.
But like, how fun for you guys on that stage to kind of just absorb like insane amount of love given to you guys. Yeah, like, you know, that's just, I think that's a great, what a gig. Oh,
it was
my
the best,
God.
It was the best time ever. It was the,
and is that your favorite Broadway experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I have to tell you a Bernadette Peters story too, because.
Oh, please. Yes.
She replaced Bette. And, there was one time when, she, you know, the hat shop scene is a farce. So it required a lot of people running around and hiding in cupboards and hiding under tables and all this
kind
of stuff.
That's right.
And she and Victor Garber had a lot of rapid fire dialogue back and forth to each other. And one day, well into their run, 3 or 4 weeks into their run, they got in a loop where she said something and he said the response. And then she said the same thing that she had just said back to him. Yeah. And he said the same response. And then they were lost and they didn't know what to say. So she just stopped and she said to Victor, and I'm on stage. I'm on the all the way on the other side of the stage.
Yeah.
And I've done the show more than the two of them have.
Yes.
But I'm going to stay there and watch. She turns to Victor and she says, "Do you know what I'm supposed to say right now?" and he goes, nope, no, I don't, no. And so then she turns around to the cabinet where Gavin Creel is hiding inside. Cornelius is hiding inside the cabinet. And all of her lines up to this point have been like, "No, Mr. Van de Gelder, you can't go in there. There's no one in there. No, why would there be anybody in there?" She opens up the cabinet and puts her little face in there and says to Gavin, on mic, "Do you know what I'm supposed to say right now?" And you hear Gavin just laughing and laughing and laughing. And then
what does the audience do when this is happening?
Freaking out, applauding and laughing.
Oh my God.
They were dying. It was so funny.
I love this. Oh my God. Wow. I totally forgot about Bernadette Peters in this show too.
Yeah. Then she then went off. She said, "Hold please." And she went off stage and she talked to the stage manager.
Oh, I thought you were going to say she came back out with the script.
She talked to the stage manager. The stage manager said, "This is what you say." And she said, "Got it." And she came back in. And then everybody applauded and laughed. And then she started over. Yeah.
Oh, my God. That is so fun. See, that is so fun for an audience. Oh, my word.
Do you know what I'm supposed to say right now is the best. It's the best. It's the best.
Can we – I just want to say a quick story about David Hyde Pierce because I don't know him at all, but I met him once and he was so kind for no reason. I actually auditioned for him. He was directing a show at George Street. I went in. It was the like maybe first and only audition I went on because someone said, "You should go in for this." And I was like, "I don't know how to be an actor, but here we go. Let's go give it a shot." And I went in and he like talked to me and like asked me about my whole background. They gave me a few points. I didn't get the job at all, but he spent like a half hour with me when there's like actual actors waiting to come in and do this. I was like, what a gentle, nice man he is. Is he kind as I remember him being from that one?
100%. He loves people and he loves theater people. And he, you know, I would show up. We shared a floor at the Schubert. His dressing room and my dressing room were on the same floor.
Yeah.
And oftentimes I would go in and say hi to him before the show. And I remember I came back from a vacation once, a week away, and he said, "Welcome home." You know, he considered the theater his home.
Yeah.
And all of us his family. David knew everybody's name and everybody's birthday in that building.
Oh,
if
Jesus.
It was your birthday, whether you were front of house or you pulled the flies or you sewed the costumes, he would give you a bottle of champagne and a handwritten birthday card.
Oh my God.
From David Hyde Pierce. Yeah. He threw a giant party for everybody to come to his home in the Hamptons and go to the beach one summer and hosted everyone. He loves doing theater. He loves people. He is genuinely interested in finding out about everybody. So I'm not surprised at all that he spent a half an hour getting to know you. And I'm sure he remembers it all. And when he comes to see something that you do, he'll say, "Hi, Drew." and he'll know all about, you know, he'll
he's getting an invite to Karate Kid. There's not a question. Let's have him come. Of course. Oh my God. Him and Dwayne The Rock Johnson, the other person. They can sit right next to each other. Okay. You heard it here first, folks. What Kate is saying is if you're going to be in a Broadway show, make sure to do it with uber famous people so that they can invite you to their homes in the Hamptons. And you get those types of perks as well. That's why we do theater. Let's not forget.
Well, can I tell you too? I left Colin. I brought Colin with me to that party, and we left his Transformers.
One of the
backpack.
Few times you took him out of the house, otherwise you just leave him in there all by himself. Yes,
under a blanket reading a book. That's his happy place. And we, by mistake, left his Transformers backpack at David's house.
Yes.
And so I texted David. I said, "I'm so sorry. I think scatterbrain mommy left the backpack there. Would you please bring it in?" And he sent me a picture of, you know, of himself with the backpack on, you know, walking down.
Yes.
He would walk every day from his home on the Upper West Side to the theater. Yes. That was like his warm up. That was his way of getting into what he needed to do for the show. And, you know, always very unassuming, like, you know, it just like in his regular clothes with like Colin's back. He sent me a picture of him with Colin's backpack. You
just
know,
walking through New York.
Yeah.
I love that.
Walking to work.
People taking pictures of him being like, David Hyde Pierce has really lost his mind, I think. Wow. Okay. I want to jump to something real quick. Because you've worked with the late, great, and everybody's superhero, Mr. Stephen Sondheim. Mm-hmm. You've sung for him. This is correct. You just posted a picture where you're in like the bluest gown of all time.
Oh, I call it the Statue of Liberty. It's
it
my
had
Statue
the
of Liberty
biggest
plan.
Shoulder. Yeah. It yeah. had just one shoulder.
Yeah. That was for distraction, Drew, because I was like 4 months pregnant at the time.
Okay.
And I was still not telling people. So I was like, I know, I'll get a big shoulder and no one will look at my belly.
I'll draw the eye up to my shoulder, which looks like a weird Tim Burton character on the side of my body here.
Totally.
Okay, so you worked with him. Andrew Lippa, who wrote Big Fish, is another amazing composer. I think he's really, really tremendous. And the list really, truly goes on. David Yazbek and all these amazing people that you've Tom Kitt, oh my God. I just texted you the other day saying, holy shit, superhero, you sound beautiful, amazing on it. My question to you, knowing that you've worked with all these amazing, Drew Gasparini, obviously, the Karate Kid workshop with us, we had a great time. What makes a great song? And I might take notes as you tell me. But as someone who interprets some of the best songs ever written, it is an interesting question to ask because a writer is going to have a different point of view. But I love hearing it from a performer because that's who I care about. When I show a new song to a writer, the note they give me, I always hear as, well, here's how I would have written the song. But when I hear it from an actor, I hear what's needed. Because they also need a few things in the song for them to really bite into it or find the emotionality or this, that, and the other, unless it's perfectly written and they're given everything they need. But to you, Kate Baldwin, Broadway icon, what makes a great song?
That's a lot, Drew. I'm going to try my best.
No.
I think context is everything. And so when we talk about songs for the music theater, we're talking about a character in a specific situation. And I think in thinking about Steve Sondheim and his work over the past couple of days, as we all have been thinking about him, what makes his work so fun for actors to do is the specificity with which he writes, the specificity of time and place and of point of view of the character. And that's what makes his work kind of difficult to pull out of the show and do, say, in a concert, in a standalone 54 Below show.
Yeah.
When I'm looking for material to do there, I have to understand that what plays well to an audience that knows musical theater really well is one thing. But if I take that song that I love and I consider a good song to an audience that maybe isn't as familiar with musical theater, they're not going to appreciate it in the same way. It might be a little less accessible to them.
Right.
Because it's going to stand alone. Or I might have to do a lot of work to set it up and to provide the context of the show. I think, Drew, what you did so brilliantly in your show that I just saw at 54 Below was you gave context for the very personal songs that you created about your dad, your mom, the tree, all the things. And I remember vividly the ways you set up those stories so that it launched us into the song with a visual picture in our head. Because as much as I want to think that we are auditorially astute people, we are visual animals first.
Yes.
So I think about the image that you put in your head when you're writing a song or when I'm singing a song. I need to have that image in my head of what is the picture that I'm describing as I'm singing here. And who am I singing to is often the most important part as well. I think that can change a song. That can change a song 100% when you decide if the person you're singing to is your mother or, you know, a person you want to sleep with. Like, it's just the completely different opposite. Why did I put those two things? I don't know.
I don't know either. They're too there was too close to have those two thoughts.
I was trying to give the farthest opposite spectrum. I think I did it.
They were said too close together and they threw our heads for a loop.
Now everybody feels awkward.
I really do. I love what you just said about, I think it's just making sure the audience is where you're at too. So they can see everything you're seeing without them actually seeing it. You know what I mean? The song paints the picture for the performer. The performer's painting the picture for the audience.
That's right.
You know, I don't know. It goes layers that way. But I think you're right. Context is a big, big thing.
And I think you do yourself a disservice when you say that you're not an actor, because I do think you're an actor. I think you have to be an actor writing the song because you're...
Is that coming from Broadway icon Kate Baldwin? Jeez.
Well, it's just the truth. I think every writer I've ever worked with has to put themselves in the shoes of the character. So you have to get behind the point of view of the character. And that's what makes your job exciting and fun to explore. I remember you saying early on in Karate Kid, like, I'm not a mom, I don't have children, tell me what this is about. And that's exactly what Stephen Sondheim did to his friend Mary Rogers. I'm not married, I don't understand what marriage is. You tell me your stories about marriage and I'll write them down. So you're doing the work. You're doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing as a writer.
It's so exhausting to tap into other people's emotions. Let me tell you. Okay, can I tell you what I read in your Wikipedia page?
Oh, Lord.
This is how Wikipedia says you and Graham met. By the way, I can't. I've worked with 2/3 of your household. I've worked with you. I've worked with Graham. It's really fun.
If you ever want to musicalize the horror story about siblings, let me know.
I do. I can get you
in touch with Colin.
That's they're there. What is it called? What does he say?
They're there. That's exactly right. They're there.
That is such a great title too. They're there.
Yeah.
It says you guys met because you had lots of downtime during Act Two of 1776.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. What do you do in the downtime? And like, it led to a marriage and a child. How fun. Were you guys making out backstage?
Drew,
Why can't I ask that question?
You don't even have to say that, do you? No,
were you all necking?
That's such like my mother's like term from the 60s. Were you necking? I was definitely just wearing my bloomers and my corset and maybe a t-shirt because as Martha Jefferson, I didn't want to hang out in my, you know, big old fancy plantation dress backstage if I didn't have to. But he was definitely wearing his like Brian Boitano-esque shirt as a
Beautiful.
As a signer of the Declaration of Independence, Richard Henry Lee, which is the role he played, who, you know, sings the third song in the entire show and then is gone for the rest of it.
Right.
And I'm Martha Jefferson, who sings maybe like the sixth song in the show and then is gone for the rest of it.
Perfect. What another great gig.
Yeah, right?
Great gig.
So we would just hang out. What would we do? We would watch American Idol. This was circa 2003, okay?
So
we'd watch American Idol. We would play video games. We would maybe watch a little bit of 24 starring Kiefer Sutherland.
Yeah, Kiefer Sutherland. Hell yeah.
And maybe we would sample bourbon. I don't know. There's this man named Johnny Walker, and he makes good stuff.
Love this. I do. If you guys wrote a book about your romance, would it be called Lots of Downtime?
I mean, and every day since then has had zero downtime. So I'm grateful that we had the downtime when we did.
Yeah, because you guys hit the ground running.
Well, and that opportunity to just like hang out, it was really great because we got to know each other really well and we made each other laugh and we were kind of silly together. And Drew, this is even nerdier, we would go home from the show at night, like go home to our respective apartments or whatever. And then do you remember IMing instant messaging on
of
AOL?
Of course I do. Yes.
We would do that too until like this 2 or 3 in the morning.
God, this is so pure. And
it was, literally like, what are you watching on TV right now? What channel is that on? Okay. Oh, I'll watch that. What are you eating? Okay. I'm going to make some of that too. Like,
I love this.
It was so silly.
That is adorable.
I fell in love with him like that. And we didn't do any kissing until we were out of the theater.
Good. Okay. That's so very professional of you.
We're not making out. Because then we thought, oh, this is so cliche. Like to make out. That would be.
A showman's, they call it. A showman's.
And we certainly didn't want it to be a showman's. We were very concerned that it could just be that. And Graham, I give Graham a lot of credit because I was the one who pointed at him and said, you mean let's go. And he was like, hang on. Are you the
slow down?
Deal? Yeah, yeah.
Oh
yeah,
boy.
Yeah.
Well, here you are, 18 years or whatever later. That's amazing. I love to hear it, and I just think you guys are like both of the sweetest people that I've met in this industry. So it's really great that it all worked out. I want to end the interview here with something I do on every episode, and it's literally called "Stupid Questions with Drew." Do you think I should have theme music for this portion?
I
haven't done it. There's been like 50 episodes and I have yet to do it, but maybe for this I'll
just imagine that you're a songwriter who's hosting a podcast and put yourself in that point of view, and
I'll
then
try
to
get
to
there
you.
That's a stretch. Kate Baldwin, here are some stupid questions. I cannot wait to hear these answers. If you were arrested for something and your face was suddenly all over the news, what would your family and friends assume you did?
Inadvertently poisoning someone with, bad food or something.
Oh, I love that. An inadvertent poisoning with bad food.
With bad food. Because I like to cook for people. But sometimes I get a little bit of, you do this too. You love to cook for people too.
Love to cook for people.
Yeah. Sometimes I get a little too ambitious and I've wrecked some food. Fortunately, I always overdo it instead of underdo it. I don't think anybody's gotten food poisoning from what I've made. Or if they have, they haven't told me.
Okay. But like, they might not be able to tell you because they're dead now. So.
I also never ask if anybody has any food allergies or or if they're a vegetarian or if they don't eat dairy. I just put all that shit in there.
It's not about them, baby. Well, it's about you. You're doing the work.
I love sugar. I love dairy. I'm going to put it all. Why wouldn't you love those things? Yeah, why wouldn't I give those to you?
You just have a pan and you just scrape all that shit off the counter right into a pan. You put it in the oven.
I'm sorry if what I made
loaf
and I would inadvertently kill somebody because of what I made for them. Yep.
That is a tremendous answer for this.
Thank you.
Inadvertent poisoning. So great. Okay.
That's true.
This is a horrible question. And I'm so sorry because you are so wholesome and pure. And I'm sorry I'm going to ask this to you.
Oh, God.
You have to give up one thing for a year, and it has to be one of these two things.
Oh, Lord.
Brushing your teeth or wiping your butt.
Oh. Oh. You can't not wipe your butt. Now, wait a minute. Can I shower every day?
If you really want to. Yeah, because you could bidet it. You could bidet in a shower.
That's what I would do.
Yeah, you just bend at the right angle. You spread cheek, and then you let the shower.
You take it, right? Yep.
I do the same thing. Okay, good answer.
That's what it would be. Because I gotta keep flossing.
Broadway, that's right. That's right.
I'm old. Yeah.
Well, the shower is essentially, that could be a water pick, one of those.
Okay.
Anyway, keep your assholes clean, kids. Kate Baldwin, Broadway, 2-time Tony nominee, Kate Baldwin. Next question for you. Would you rather feel itchy all the time or sticky all the time?
Itchy. I live with being itchy all the time. I have the driest skin. Have you seen my hands? Next time we're together,
hands.
I'll show you my witchy, witchy hands.
You have witchy hands?
Yeah. My friend Jessica Snow Wilson, we were working together about, 15 years ago. And she's like, Kate, what's wrong with your hands? And I was like, I don't know. They've always been like this.
Wow.
She's like, were you doing dishes last night? I was like, no. This is just how my hands are. They are incredibly dry. I'm dry.
Do you lotion?
All the time. Yeah. My body just sucks it in. I've never found a lotion that satisfies my witchy hands.
We need to find you a sleeping apparatus that goes all the way up to the neck that you fill with lotion. So overnight you're steeped in it.
Yes.
And also I want one too, because that just sounds really kind of fun.
And then it'll work so well with my night sweats too. That'll be
a good combo. You are a joy.
That'll be a good combo, right?
My night sweats. Okay. Last couple insane questions with Kate Baldwin here before I let her go. Kate Baldwin,
What?
You live in Jersey. You lived in New York. You're from the Midwest. There's good eats in all those locations. Yes. I'm going to ask you about something in specific. Can you walk us through the best breakfast sandwich?
Oh, the best breakfast sandwich.
Yeah, layer it for us. Would it be a bagel? Would it be
it would be a brioche. It would be a brioche bun.
God, yes.
Some kind of like crusty, Frenchy something or other. Okay. There would have to be some kind of like oozy fried egg on there that can like ooze out.
The yolky.
There would have to be, I'm going to say bacon, not sausage. I'm going to say.
Please don't be sorry.
Some kind of maple-y, smoky bacon with some kick to
it. I'm getting so hungry listening to this.
With some peppery something on there too.
Yeah. What else? You feel like you're talking dirty to me right now.
Yes.
Yeah. And what else would you put on this brioche bun?
I would smash an avocado and I would mix it with some tart lemon juice.
Oh my God.
And some flaky salt.
Wait, this is bomb. This is a kick ass. I hope everyone's writing this down. This is exactly how you should build a breakfast sandwich.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think we've got
some avocado.
We've got creamy avocado. We've got tangy. We've got some lemon juice in there for acid. We've got the fatty, spicy, maple-y, sweet.
Oh my God.
Bacon, and then you've got the umami from the egg, and then you've got the crusty brioche. I think that's it. I think that's all we
need. All the elements. You captured it all.
A Bloody Mary on the side, Drew.
Yeah, actually, that's not even the sandwich. That's just the garnish for the Bloody Mary.
You're absolutely right. I had a cassette tape called The Sondheim Songbook, Volume 1. I never got Volume 2. I only had Volume 1.
Yeah.
But it was an anthology, and it had Gypsy and West Side Story and Do I Hear a Waltz and Anyone Can Whistle and Follies and it all the way up to Night Music. I think that was the last one. And then Volume 2 would have been Sweeney Todd on. But that to me was incredible. And that cassette tape I just played over and over and over again. And I know every breath, every phrasing choice, everything on that on that cassette tape. And I'm so grateful that I had that. As a kid, because it forced me to listen to all those shows, because that was the next song that came up, right?
Right, right.
You couldn't Spotify that. You couldn't you know, pick. Oh, I only want to listen to Maria and not, you know, Anyone Can Whistle. You had to listen to all of it. I wouldn't fast forward through it. I would just put it on and let it go.
I was just telling my girlfriend this story that I was given a gift by a parent of a student I used to teach. And it was a CD of Stephen Sondheim sitting at his, like in his house, sitting at his piano, showing like five people the first little moments of Sweeney Todd. Mm. Literally, just him and his piano. And he's not a good singer, but you're hearing him kind of flesh out this idea. It was so amazing. You'll never find it on Spotify, kids. It is just something that exists in hard form somewhere else in the world. And I think that is kind of cool.
Yeah.
Speaking of kind of cool, you are beyond kind of cool. You are so righteous. Kate, I love you.
Thank you,
I love your husband, Graham. Thanks so much for doing this. And I know there's a lot of theater kids out there who just absolutely adore you and love you. And I got to witness it firsthand with the youngsters in Karate Kid. You're so fun to be in a room with. And I can't thank you enough for coming by and doing the podcast. You're the best, Kate.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. I can't wait till we have more talks behind the music table at Karate Kid, because those are my fave.
Big time. There's going to be a lot more.
Yay.
All right. I'll talk to you soon, Kate. Bye.
Sounds good. Bye.
Thanks so much for listening, everybody. That's our show. Did you hear me lose my fucking mind while she described how she would make a breakfast sandwich? I'm going to be thinking about that all day. Now We're Talking is a proud member of the Broadway Podcast Network. You can find out more about me and this podcast at bpn.fm/Now We're Talking. Check us out on Instagram and Twitter, NWT_pod. Special thanks to our guest, Miss Kate Baldwin. Ain't she the best? Make sure to subscribe and rate this podcast at Apple Podcasts or wherever you stream your podcasts. And if you feel like supporting, please be sure to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/NWT podcast. Keep tuning in for more amazing guests every week. I love you. What can I say?
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.